I'm standing at what must be one of the most picturesque spots in any European city, in Prague's Old Town, just by the end of the 14th century Charles Bridge that spans the Vltava River. And just below me, there's a fragment of a medieval sculpture, a bearded head, built into the wall of the embankment. And this is a point against which traditionally the level of the water in the Vltava is measured. And the last time it was submerged was in August 2002. And the scenes that I remember from that time must have been very similar to what a 16-year-old English girl saw here just over 400 years ago, on the 17th of August 1598, when the floodwaters reached nearly two arms' lengths above the bearded statue. She described what she saw in a poem in Latin.
De inundatione Prague ex continuis pluvis exhorta.
Its froth sweeps everything headlong before it in whirlpools. All is carried to disaster by the raging waters. Here corn and here fruit are uprooted and surge in the waves. Here is a man, here a bed, and here his wife swims. You see beams and pine trees. You see houses swimming along. Monstrous things are tossed in the rushing channels.
The young girl who witnessed this scene was Elizabeth Jane Weston, and she went on to become one of the most celebrated poets of her time, known to her many admirers as Westonia. Few portraits of the poet survive, but one shows her as a young adult. She is dressed in court costume of the period, her hair held back by a coronet. She has a round face, dark eyes, and a high forehead, and a poised, serious expression. The poet is looking straight at us. She seems to be observing and scrutinising the world around her.
A skiff ploughs the main square. A fish defiles the shrines of the gods. The altar drips with receding floods. The crowd stand astonished, but with soaked clothing, and grieve at the total loss to these strange woes. Such was their expression, viewing angry Vltava. The waves were like those of Deucalion. Jehovah, you can tame the sea's monsters and their mad furies. Submerge all these woes with your nod.
This is wonderfully vivid poetry. It derives much from Ovid, and especially his Tristia, the exile poems he wrote from the Black Sea. But it is also innovative and highly sophisticated. And quite amazing, given that the girl who wrote these lines was still in her mid-teens. For three centuries, Elizabeth Jane Weston was all but forgotten. But today, she is once again being recognised as one of the important writers of her age. I'm going to be talking to Czech and British experts about the life and work of the English maiden, the Virgo Angla, at the court of the Emperor Rudolf II. This was a fascinating time to be living in Bohemia. Prague, in the latter part of the 16th century, was one of the most important and influential cities in Europe, the focus of the Holy Roman Empire and the seat of the Habsburg Emperor. Writer and journalist Benjamin Woolley.
There's a sort of underlying theme, this kind of universalist urge that sort of underpinned what was going on at the time, this feeling that the world was sort of disintegrating philosophically, religiously, in so many ways, but a hope, but also an aspiration to find what must be the sort of underlying universal theme, language, philosophy, religion, whatever it was that underpinned all of this.
So in a way, 16th century Bohemia was an embodiment of that step that was being taken from the medieval world to the modern world that we know today.
Well, except this is just, as it were, in the pre-modern. It's the last effort, the last attempt to use what we now call magic as a way of finding this universalist theme. And the outcome of Rudolf's particular interest in this is that he was so eclectic. He was interested in everything: astrology, alchemy, painting, new forms of writing, new forms of music, the whole everything. He was interested in this cabinet of curiosities idea, almost because you wanted as many different things to try and find the thing that united them.
And this was Elizabeth Jane Weston's world, Here are a few of the many lines that she wrote in praise of the Emperor Rudolf.
May Caesar's empire, which establishes rewards for the muses, flourish. And may Caesar's court long thrive. May the anger of the Turk be smashed, and the name of tyrant perish. Henceforth may your people worship you. May the land be fertile. May the contagions of pestilence flee. And may temples, theatres and schools all rise together.
She was a young woman, and she was extremely ambitious, I believe, in wanting to be a well-known and internationally known poet, writing Latin poetry.
Brenda Hossington is co-editor and co-translator of the collected writings of Elizabeth Jane Weston.
Because I think she was very courageous. She probably didn't have a very easy life. She felt very strongly about being an exile. She really has produced a sizable body of poetry, which up to that time, even on the continent, was probably rivaled in terms of the number of poems in Latin by the Italian Olimpia Morata. So that attracted me to her and to her verse.
I'm Susan Bassnett. I'm a writer and a professor of comparative literature. And I have been working with Elizabeth Weston, with Westonia, for over 20 years. I first encountered Westonia in Prague in the early 1980s, thanks to very distinguished Czech professor Zdeněk Štřebený. I was taken to see the grave of an English woman, an English poet, who, a contemporary of Shakespeare, was infinitely better known than Shakespeare, was in touch with all the great intellectuals and luminaries of Europe, while Shakespeare was pretty much, I suppose, a local hack. And yet Shakespeare's reputation has risen and risen and become global, and Westonia's reputation has receded to the point where, after the middle of the 18th century, nobody read her and very, very few people had even heard of her.
This happens quite often. It's happened all through literary history, and sometimes writers are deservedly forgotten. Is that not the case with Elizabeth Weston?
She isn't deservedly forgotten, in my view, but her poetry is very much of its time. She wrote a series of praise poems to friends and distinguished people. She played around with various forms of Latin verse, and none of that became really fashionable once we had Romanticism, because what she doesn't do is write passionate personal poetry. And so once the vogue for passionate personal poetry or passionate nature poetry came in, people like Westonia, who were writing in very contained forms, albeit using those forms in highly innovative and original ways, simply weren't read anymore.
Musica sit duro, suavis medicina labori, hanc superum munus, quominus ergo negem.
This is part of a poem in praise of the Flemish composer Philippe de Mont, who was living out the last years of his long life in Prague.
What is left to say? Music keeps us sound, dispels sicknesses, confirms friendships. It leads our senses to an obedient spirit and draws that same spirit to the heavens in a resounding voice. Yet I do not foolishly consider that to be harmony, which alas becomes pernicious in its allurements. But what Phoebus has blessed you with, praiseworthy Philippe, is serious, or comes only by the gift of the gods.
I've come to the town where this story starts. It's the small Cotswold market town of Chipping Norton in West Oxfordshire. It's Wednesday morning and this is market day. And there's been a market here ever since at least the 13th century, probably even further back than that, and it's always been on a Wednesday morning. And this is the town where Elizabeth Jane Weston was born. And I'm just about to go down the hill to to the magnificent Wool Church to meet two people who are going to tell me a little bit about Chipping Norton at the time when Elizabeth Jane Weston was born here, and also a bit more about her family and her roots.
I'm Adrienne Rosen, lecturer in history at Oxford University's Department for Continuing Education. Market towns were places of exchange, and they're also places of exchange of ideas and information. So we shouldn't think of a small market town like this as a place that was cut off from national life at all.
And of course it's only a few miles away from Stratford-upon-Avon, where another rather well-known literary figure was born.
Yes, these market towns were not at all backwaters.
And what about Elizabeth Jane Weston's family?
I'm Jan Cliff, a member of the Chipping Norton Historical Research Group, and we have found the will of Elizabeth's grandfather, Thomas Cooper, who died around 1577-78. We don't know his occupation, but he was a fairly wealthy man when he died. His daughter Joan, or Jane Cooper, was baptised in Chipping Norton in 1563, and she married a John Weston, aged 16, in 1579.
And so those are Elizabeth Jane's parents?
That's right. In the parish registers, we have the baptisms of their two children, a son, John, in 1580, and a daughter, Elizabeth, in 1581.
And after that, we really don't know very much about the mother's side of the family at all. We've looked for John Weston, Elizabeth Jane's father, and so far that's a real mystery.
The next part of the story also remains shrouded in mystery. Shortly after losing her husband, left with two infant children and still under 20, Elizabeth Jane's mother remarried. The man she married was one of the most mysterious and to this day most controversial figures of Renaissance Europe, Edward Kelly. Kelly had become a close associate of one of the great figures of Elizabethan England, John Dee, mathematician, astronomer, astrologer, occultist, and consultant to the Queen herself. Kelly had impressed Dee with his apparent ability to communicate with spirits, and Dee employed him at his house in Mortlake as scryer, that is, a medium. Benjamin Woolley has written Dee's biography.
The thing about Kelly is that he had a kind of genius to him. If you read the spiritual diaries, what you're reading is, well, because I don't believe in magic, because I'm a modern person, what I believe to be some kind of story that Kelly made up. But it's an extraordinary story. It has, it has inconsistencies within it, but he has these visions that are truly visionary. These amazing giants with sunbeams coming out of their heads and these skittish girls. And he creates a whole cast of characters in Dee's head, which is so, and also the makings of apparently a language, the language of Enoch, this lost language that predates Babel, the Tower of Babel. So Kelly had this extraordinary mind, this extraordinary imagination, and managed to present something to Dee which was totally compelling. And that, in a sense, was the genius of Kelly. But I've no doubt, I'm afraid, in my mind, that he was ultimately a fraud.
Dee's spiritual diaries suggest that Kelly married Joan Weston on the advice of the Archangel Michael, but we can only speculate how they really came to meet. The following year, in 1583, the fates of the Dee and Kelly families changed spectacularly as a result of one of their many seances.
One of these visions involved some sort of angelic character who told Dee to go to Prague to confront the Holy Roman Emperor himself, Rudolf II, to try and shape his kind of intellectual course and his understanding of what was going on. So Dee set off.
They all set off in a kind of vast ménage. And I've written elsewhere about the complexities of the journey they had to take, because they couldn't simply go straight across Europe, because in some cases they would be in Catholic territory, in some cases in Protestant territory. And so they went on a long, convoluted journey through the Low Countries, northern Germany, Baltic coast, down through Poland, and ended up in Prague. But I think the families are with them.
When John Dee and Edward Kelly first arrived in Prague, they actually came to the spot where I'm now sitting. Now there's a pub here, and this is on Bethlehem Square in the heart of the old town. And next to me is Michal Pobert, who has been long fascinated by Dee and Kelly. Tell me about this place, Michal.
They literally arrived in Prague, sort of got out of their carriage and established themselves in this small, very small, Dee calls it this little study that belonged to Tadej Hayek, and this was their base.
And pretty much immediately, Dee and Kelly started sort of gazing into the crystal ball, didn't they, here in this house?
Yeah, well, it wasn't a crystal ball, it was a stone, actually, which they called a scrying stone.
When they were having one of their seances, a spirit told Kelly that Dee should try to talk to the Emperor, to Rudolf, and that he should warn Rudolf that he's in danger of going off the rails, as we'd say today.
My version of it would be more something like that he should mend the error of his ways. And it definitely was not what an emperor expected to hear.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Dee and Kelly fell rather quickly out of favour with the court. They were lucky that scientists and alchemists were very much in demand in Renaissance Bohemia, and they caught the eye of one of the most powerful of all the Bohemian nobles, William of Rosenberg, or Rosenberg.
The entire Dee and Kelly families came here, to the castle at Trzeboń in South Bohemia, still as idyllically beautiful today as it would have been then. Its facade covered with intricate plasterwork and set in a landscape of forests and fish ponds. This was where Elizabeth Jane and her brother John Francis would have spent much of their early childhood.
The Rosenbergs became the patrons of Dee and Kelly, hoping to get something out of what these two people were apparently capable of doing, and this moved Dee pretty decisively in the direction of alchemy, and they engaged in some sort of set of alchemical experiments. But they also continued with these spiritual seances, which culminated in this extraordinary seance in which Dee was apparently being told by Kelly that he needed to sleep with Kelly's wife and Kelly needed to sleep with Dee's wife in order to, as it were, bring about some sort of consummation, if you like, of their spiritual quest. This actually happened.
Kelly went off to make his fortune back in Prague, and Dee went off virtually in disgrace back to Britain, having lost a great deal of the status that he'd had before, didn't he?
Why things turned so decisively in Kelly's favour and against Dee is not entirely clear, but it's something to do with his relationship with changes that were going on in England at the time. And as you say, he returned in disgrace and he ultimately ended up dying in poverty, while Kelly went off and became famous even in England as this great alchemist.
The family came to live here on what's now Charles Square in Prague's new town that had been founded just across the river in the second half of the 14th century by Charles IV. And the house that they lived in, it's since been rebuilt later in the 17th century, but it's still on the same site. And aptly enough, part of the house now houses a chemist's shop, which I think Edward Kelly would have thoroughly approved of. And Renaissance scholar Eliška Fučíková tells me that this would have been a pretty desirable place to live at the end of the 16th century.
This is, in fact, at the corner of the biggest medieval square in Prague, even bigger than the Wenceslas Square. And it was one of the biggest squares in the whole medieval Europe. This was, in fact, the most flourishing time for the Rudolphine court, because this is the time when most of the artists came to Prague, changing the castle in a really exquisite late mannerist residence. These new buildings devoted completely to Rudolph's collections.
And Edward Kelly, or Lord Kelly as he now was, proved a devoted stepfather to Elizabeth Jane and John Francis.
Both the children received, obviously, an excellent education in the classics and in other matters as well that perhaps we know less about, but certainly in the classics. And again, I suppose that it is very much to his credit that he gave Elizabeth the same kind of education that he gave John Francis. This was not often the case for girls. And so probably the children were tutored together. This is very much what happens to young girls in the period, that they sit in on their brother's classes.
The fact that Elizabeth Jane had such an impressive education is not entirely surprising.
I think there are two issues, really. One is the actual history of women's education in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is quite cloudy. A lot has come to light in the last 30 years. Before that, it was generally assumed that only boys were educated and girls were not, and we now know that's nonsense. One of the most interesting cases I can think of is Lucrezia Borgia. We all think of her as a poisoner, an adulteress or whatever. In fact, she was really a very erudite, very learned woman who wrote a little bit of verse herself, but also cultivated around her some very, very high-level poets and, of course, conversed in Latin. And we tend to forget all that. We tend to forget the high level of women's education at the court of Isabella and Ferdinand of Spain, which is why Mary Tudor and ultimately Elizabeth were so well educated. And Latin was the absolute cornerstone, because Latin was regarded as the supreme language, the sublime language. If you could compose good verse in Latin, this was a demonstration not just of your intellect and of your status, but also really in a sense of your innate poetic ability. And so there's a whole number of women who tried their hand at this.
So there was nothing eccentric in Elizabeth Jane taking up her pen. We've already heard how at the age of 16 she described Prague being struck by floods, and some of her best verse gives us a taste of the atmosphere of Rudolfine Prague. I've now come to the Loreto Square, just above Prague Castle, and I'm standing by a very old wall with a Renaissance gate in it. And through the gate I can see what's now a rather overgrown garden with a pond and some fruit trees, and beyond that the Baroque Loreto Shrine. In Westonia's time, here or very close by, was one of Prague's many celebrated Italian gardens. This particular garden, here up at Loreto, it belonged to a close Kelly family friend, the lawyer and patron of the arts, Johann Barvitius. And Elizabeth Jane sang the praises of both the garden and its owner.
Here is a garden richly cultivated with aromatic plants, cultivated and nourished by Barvitius's assiduous care. Here you relieve your wearied breast of its cares, whenever Caesar's court releases you in a state of exhaustion. This place welcomes your trusted friends as well. Here is an opportunity for seeing and conversing. Here you are accustomed, out of your intrinsic goodness, to hear the prayers of widows and take up the petitions of clients. Thus his flourishing garden serves a lord. Thus a lord rejoices in the splendour of his garden.
But Renaissance Prague was also a place of complex political intrigue, especially for someone as notoriously hot-headed and outspoken as Edward Kelly. Despite the sense of order and harmony in the poem we've just heard, in all probability Elizabeth Jane did not have the easiest of childhoods.
He wasn't possibly the most reliable figure to have around. He wouldn't always have the money that would sustain the family and so on. But he was clearly a great charismatic figure. He was wonderful. A person just to be with. It was almost like having, in modern terms, a rock star for a father, some charismatic, often rather remote figure who would suddenly be flush with money one minute and then the next he would be in prison. And it would be that kind of unstable, exciting life that she probably led as a child of Edward Kelly.
Again and again, Kelly found himself on the wrong side of the imperial court. He was arrested on several occasions, most dramatically in 1591. We don't quite know what happened. The most picturesque version, and the one that has gone down in popular legend, is that Kelly killed a fellow courtier, a certain Jiří Hunkler, in a duel. Wherever the truth lies, the impact on the family's fortunes was spectacular.
Edward Kelly was sent here to Křivoklát Castle, which is about 30 miles to the west of Prague. It's a 13th century Gothic castle in the middle of the woods on a hilltop. And at the time of Rudolf II, it was a prison. There's a huge oak door opening, and we're in, well, which what looks very much like a medieval dungeon. It doesn't look like a pleasant place to stay. And after 4 years, he tried to escape.
Edward Kelly was caught, granted an amnesty, but we know that he was arrested again. The story has it that he committed suicide in 1597, and that his family helped to smuggle the poison into his cell. Whether Elizabeth Jane was involved, we shall probably never know. But what is clear is that she and her brother John Francis cared passionately about the injustice they felt had been done to the family. Through no less a weapon than poetry itself, and with crusading zeal, Elizabeth Jane set about clearing her stepfather's name and winning back the family's confiscated estates. And amazingly, for a girl still in her teens, she succeeded. Czech scholar Lucia Storchová has devoted years to studying Westonia's poetry.
At the very beginning, she started to write poems and send poems to relatives, let's say family friends, who had some important position at the court. It was a great network of courtiers of Rudolf II, and she contacted them and tried to get some support.
To the illustrious prince and lord, Lord Peter Vok of Rosenberg, her most gracious lord and Maecenas. To my parent you granted freely held properties, which envy carried off from us, who deserve no such treatment, gnashing its savage teeth. What a fate, making us sorrowful paupers. To the illustrious and most noble hero and lord, Lord Popple of Lobkowitz. I seek no vulgar applause by my poetry, nor do I ask any great gifts from you. What I beg is that you not let a wretched maiden and her widowed mother perish under the weight of an unfair evil. My plea is not without merit. Only look at our case, and you will see that we are innocent in bearing such ills.
It was a very delicate balancing act. You had to impress the patron. You couldn't just merely appear destitute, impoverished, and pathetic. There had to be a sort of edge to it, or an aspect to it, or a colour to it that made you appealing to the patron. So they would think you were in some way worthy because of the way that you had addressed them. You were worthy of their patronage.
I think that she was very smart, as well as being a very good poet. These begging poems, as they're sometimes called, there are hundreds and hundreds of them in Neo-Latin verse. I mean, this is not unusual. We mustn't blame her for seeming to be materialistic, for example, or using verse for ends other than purely aesthetic or literary. This is very, very common at the time. But I think that said, she did exploit her youth. She exploited her gender, most certainly.
In what ways?
Well, there's this whole thing in the Renaissance about the learned lady, as they like to call them, or even more so about the precocious young lady who could write in Latin, or who could do Latin and Greek, or Latin, Greek and Hebrew, and so on and so forth. And I think that she's very aware of this type, that is to say, the erudite young woman that so many male poets and male patrons seem to love. So often they make comments like, and for a woman, she knew Latin and Greek, which is unusual. And not only is she a good poet, but she's a girl, and her poetry is nearly as good as men's, which is a comment you find constantly in writings of the time. But I think that she exploited her Englishness, her gender, her youth, and also, and rightly so, her ability to write poetry.
And so here is Westonia, surrounded by these various influential figures, nobles, people hovering around the court of Rudolf. How did they perceive her?
I think that they always place an emphasis on her singularity and miraculousness, let's say, as if she were the best female poet in the whole history of humankind and so on. You can find a lot of phrases in this sense. Sometimes they also raise her to a deity, as if she were a goddess.
And Westonia herself in the only poem she addressed to a woman, to the noblewoman Margaret von Balthoven, on her marriage, gave the following advice.
In all your duties, remember to appease him. If you wish to avoid frequent strife in the marriage bed, it is the husband's role to command, and ours to obey. For he is the head, and we are the mutual members for him.
We don't know to what extent Margaret Balthoven followed Westonia's recommendations, but we do know that Margaret's brother, the young Silesian poet Georg Martinius von Balthoven, was to play an important role in Westonia's life. Recognising her talents and her family's unfortunate circumstances, he worked tirelessly to get her work published. Westonia expressed her gratitude in a number of poems.
You have been bold to call me a bard in your lofty song, and associate me with a Parnassian choir. Indeed, you bring me fame. Yet you yourself shine the more for your praise, and are the worthier to be sung on the lyre. For your poems show you to me for who you are. I read them, and they bent my mind just as they intended. For you, form and content flow in an easy path, so that you can overcome Ovid in your verses.
Through Balthoven, her first collection, the Poemata, was published in 1602, and her reputation spread quickly throughout the courts of Europe. That Elizabeth Jane was successful in saving her family's reputation and fortune is reflected in the fact that in 1603 she married Johannes Leo, a prominent lawyer at Rudolf's court.
She wrote a lot less once she was married, and I think it is right to say that this is very typical of young women poets in the period. A lot of them wrote while they were in their teens, before they were married, and then either produced less or produced nothing after they were married, presumably because the tasks of running a household and being a wife and mother took their toll in terms of creative output. Their creativity was channeled in other directions. So she did write a lot less. She was, I think, happily married. This is the impression that we have from her verses. In her poem on the death of her mother, she counts as one of the wonderful things that has happened in her life, the fact that she met her husband and has been happily married to him. But at the same time, this probably took away a lot of her spare time, for one thing, but also her energy. I'm not sure that her ambition lessened. Perhaps she thought that she would go back and write more verse, but of course this was not to be.
Elizabeth Jane was certainly kept busy with her household. Over the next 9 years, she had no less than 7 children, 4 boys and 3 girls. Tragically, only 3 were to survive infancy. Her poetry and correspondence hint at the kind of life she led, running a household in Prague. She corresponds with one of her stepfather's close associates, the alchemist Oswald Kroll, hoping to take advantage of his skills as a doctor.
Relying on your extraordinary benevolence toward us, most gentle Master Kroll, I am sending you this serving woman of my mother, who for nearly 3 weeks has been afflicted with a very severe headache, which I think takes its origin from some obstruction, as she herself reports. If you will send her something from your outstanding collection of drugs, you will both do a great favour to my absent mother, and also free me of a burden of care, since I am anxiously concerned for the girl. Farewell. And please attribute this boldness of mine to necessity. Elizabeth Jane Weston.
I have given the girl a remedy for headache as you request. At the same time, I am sending the promised ophthalmic water, from which 1 drop or 2 should be given to the eyes daily just before going to bed. From its continued and harmless use, the eyesight is sharpened remarkably. From one most respectful of you and your virtues, Dr. Oswald Kroll.
The fact that she was grateful to Kroll for his remedies is seen in her vigorous defence of his writings. It was a brave act of loyalty to a family friend, as Kroll had fallen seriously out of favour with the court.
Since Kroll exposes himself so boldly to envy In publishing works praised by learned physicians, he has as much perfected his monuments to perennial virtue as he has provided a work of sincere piety. But since he puts forth works pleasing to God and healthful to ailing limbs, for me he will always be Phoebus Apollo.
After her marriage, Westonia certainly remained very interested in her work being published, and a further edition of her poetry and correspondence, known as the Parthenicon, or Maidenly Writings, was published around 1608. And we can find evidence of her continued interest in her poetry here at the British Library, just next door to St Pancras Station in central London, where the curator of the Czech and Slovak collections, Susan Reynolds, is going to show me a rather special edition of Westonia's poetry from the library collection.
What we've got here is a first edition, first printed edition, of the Parthenicon, which was her second book of poetry. And this one is dated in manuscript Prague, 16th of August, 1610. So that's only a couple of years before the poetess died. And in this volume we have in front of us here, there is a manuscript poem in which she addresses the reader, and she expresses herself as being not at all ashamed to have written poetry, in Latin as well, at a time when to do such for a woman was considered really unfitting.
And it's fascinating, isn't it, this poem, because she's writing there in her own handwriting that, she's not entirely happy with this edition of the poetry, is she? And she's sort of saying that somebody's put in other poems and that she hopes one day that an edition more worthy of her abilities as a poet will be published. So she's really quite feisty, isn't she? And quite you can see that she's quite determined as a poet.
Yes, I think that even shows in the handwriting, which is very firm, very well formed.
And it's lovely, the frontispiece here has actually got a little woodcut of Elizabeth Jane Weston with a pen in hand.
Yes, here she is, and she's looking, obviously, in the throes of poetic inspiration, wearing a splendid 17th-century dress complete with ruffled collar. And in her hand, as you say, in her right hand, she's bearing the plume with which to transcribe her latest inspirations.
Elizabeth Jane was in her late 20s when she penned the lines now in the British Library. She herself never managed to return to the country of her birth, and a poem that she addressed to King James I to mark his accession to the throne remained unanswered, much to Westonia's disappointment. But she would certainly have been known in Britain. Within her lifetime, Westonia had become one of the most celebrated writers north of the Alps. But she had little time to enjoy her fame. Bearing 7 children had taken its toll on her health, and she died in 1612 at the age of just 30. I've come to the place where Elizabeth Jane Weston's earthly journey ends. It's in Prague's ancient Lesser Quarter. We're just outside St. Thomas's Church, where Westonia is buried. And next to me is the priest, Father William Fay. So let's go in. Well, we're just entering the cloister now. And this is a little oasis of quiet with the green lawn in the middle and a well. And around the cloister, there are various Renaissance tombstones set into the wall. And at the end here, on the right,
is the tomb of Elizabeth Jane.
And there is a faded but readable inscription in Latin. It actually describes as nobilitate patriae praeclara Britanniae, this noble figure from Britain. And then it goes on, doesn't it, to describe her as the Minervae Floris and the Musarum Delicii.
Right, the delight of the muses and
the flower of Minerva,
of course.
And at the very end, a Feminarum Exempli, is it?
And an example for all women. So she's quite literate.
And what is also rather touching in this on this gravestone is that it refers at the end to her family and to the fact that she
had 7 children. 3 daughters which survived her, and 4 sons whom she buried, and it's quite sad. I think she was about 30 years.
It says, doesn't it, in the inscription, it says 30 years and 4 weeks.
Yeah, 30 years and 4 weeks, So
she was incredibly young, and she buried also her mother. Her brother died when he was a student.
Yeah, and so it was, this was rather a sad life in a way, and yet at the same time there's something very optimistic about it, in a sense that it lists her accomplishments and, fulsome praises,
And also the fact that here we are 400 years later, almost exactly 400 years later, remembering her.
Remembering her. Someone like Elizabeth Weston's memory is still very much alive, as quite a great poetess,
No one who has not been touched by it can speak of the force and power of insatiable death. Indeed, I would have thought it raged through bodies only, and could not wound the spirit with its darts. But the reality teaches me far otherwise, and makes me speak as one who has been wounded and is experienced. Death's savagery is wont to be greater against the inner mind, lesser against the members of the body. When it has overwhelmed the latter and transfixed it with a sharp missile, there is no room for more wounds. But I know not to how many torments the mind is subject. In how many ways can death overwhelm the heart's senses? For however many of your dear kinsmen it extinguishes, however many friends it causes to perish in death, so many wounds it inflicts on you, or as it were directly on your heart, so often it destroys you with its torments.
In her short life, Elizabeth Jane Weston had produced 2 full volumes of poetry and numerous shorter poetic pamphlets. She had also contributed poems to the collections of many of her contemporaries. About 20 years after her death, in 1634, Thomas Farnaby, in his list of eminent ancient and modern writers, published in London, the Index Poeticus, included Westonia as one of only 7 English writers, and the only woman in the entire list. With the demise of Latin, and the rise of vernacular languages in the course of the 17th century, she was forgotten almost instantly. But her poetry deserves to be read, even if we can approach it only in translation. Here are the closing lines of what is probably Elizabeth Jane Weston's most personal poem, her tribute on the death of her mother. It speaks clearly through the centuries.
No longer will she advise me with her maternal words, nor will she be there for me to say, "Help me, mother." No longer will she be there to bless her descendants and me, making the sign of the cross on forehead and breast. At least let my destiny be kindly henceforth. May my offspring be safe, I pray, and let my husband live. I shall bear in good spirit whatever else fate may bring. And even if I myself follow my mother, when the time comes, death will be the source for me of a better life. And you, mother, eternally venerable, farewell. And take as a final gift these tears of mine. Elizabeth Jane Leo, of the family of Weston, Englishwoman.